Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The Andy J Podcast. The Andy J Podcast.
Hey, welcome to the very latest episode of the Andy J Podcast. Really appreciate you taking the time to check us out. I hope you are a regular listener, but if this is your first show, we have one heck of a conversation for you. It's with Professor Green, also known, of course, as Stephen Manderson. Now, as Professor Green, he is a multi-platinum selling artist, a rapper, a TV presenter, a big style personality, a man who you watch on your screens and hear in your headphones. As Stephen, he's a new dad and he's a really lovely bloke. Now, I do need to flag up, there are some issues in this conversation that may cause you some concern. And Stephen is very, very open about the life that he has led. He has had a challenging and tough time of it, from several brushes with death in his own life to also the fact that his father committed suicide. So I'm flagging that now because they, of course, do come up in this conversation, and Stephen speaks very openly and very candidly about all of these things, as well as plenty of other fascinating stories. He is an astonishing guy, and he was such an open and brilliant guest. I really, really enjoyed our conversation. He's a very thoughtful man. He's a big thinker, super bright. And of course, because of the life he's lived and the experiences he's had, he's so informed. I was really impressed. I admire Stephen hugely. I liked him enormously. And I hope you enjoy this conversation. I'll stop waffling. I just wanted to say thank you and enjoy.
The Andy J Podcast.
We have a very special guest for the whole show today. He's a multi-platinum selling artist, rapper, TV presenter, and he's also a new dad. I am thrilled to welcome the man they call Stephen Manderson, a.k.a. Professor Green. How are you doing, Steve? You all right?
Yeah, I'm really good, thank you. That was a wonderful intro, thank you.
Well, I wanted to start off with the new dad thing because I know what you're going through right now, and it is a whirlwind of joy, delight, exhaustion, fascination,
and delirium.
It's
the most fulfilling thing I've ever encountered in my life.
Really?
Yes, it is. And it's the only thing that makes you this tired and this happy for this long. Obviously, there are other things that make you tired and happy. But I don't think there's anything that makes you as consistently tired, but as consistently overwhelmingly happy.
So I'm going to share something with you straight away, Stephen. Is it okay?
Yeah.
By the way, you know, the world knows you as Professor Green. Is it all right to call you Stephen? Because it feels strange calling you Professor Green for an interview.
Yeah, it's a bit weird. I heard a rumour of Meatloaf insisting on being called Meat, which I thought was quite funny. But it would be a bit weird to be called Professor Green every time you spoke to me. I always introduce myself as Stephen, and people go, "No, you're Professor Green." I'm like, "No, I'm Stephen."
Yeah.
So Stephen, but I hate Steve. So as long as you don't call me Steve,
oh,
we'll be
I did
right.
Do that, didn't I? I did say Steve, actually, straight off the bat.
I'm only joking. It's just because my name's spelled with a PH, so you can call me Steph, but not Steve.
I gotcha. That's the dyslexic in me not getting that.
Or Steve, as my mates from Liverpool call me.
I'll go with Steve,
yeah, Steve.
And then we're ploughing the right furrow. Well, Stephen, here's the thing. Your little lad, he was born on the 15th of March, right?
Yeah.
So 10 days earlier, my little lad was born.
Amazing. And what was it, the same year?
Yeah, as in this year.
Oh, wow. You're just over a week ahead of me.
Exactly. I'm 10 days ahead of you, although two kids prior as well. He's my third son.
So a little bit more experienced and well-versed.
Well, that's why I'm intrigued, because I know what you're going through, but also I'm now experiencing for the third time as an old man now. You're 37, right? So I'm 43.
Yeah, I'm 37. That's relatively old. So what's the age difference between your kids?
So my eldest has just turned 8, literally just turned 8. Then my middle son is 3, and then obviously we've got the baby who's just, you know, brilliant.
Amazing. Are the terrible twos a thing?
So we haven't found terrible twos, actually, but we have experienced threenager.
Right, okay, because I was going to say it was quite smart to get the terrible twos out of the way before you had the third child, but if you're experiencing a threenager, which is a new term to me, but one I'm going to adopt, should I need it, then that's probably, yeah, that must be quite challenging. I mean, but it's the best challenge, isn't it? It's the one challenge with real purpose. Like, we all set ourselves goals career-wise and life-wise, but then you have a kid and you're like, oh, that's what purpose is.
Yes. I'm so pleased to hear you say that, because, I mean, I've heard you chat for so many years about all sorts of different subjects, and you've shared so much of your life. But I want to talk about everything that's happened to you and that your plans are, etc. But my hunch and guess as a dad myself is that almost everything has been reset because of this amazing new journey. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it has completely. You kind of, you still realize that, I mean, you think maybe everything's going to change, or you're going to become a completely different person, and there has been changes in me. I think a lot of them occurred prior, because I did a lot of work on myself before having a child, because I didn't want my child to ever, or to have a child. I didn't know who my child was going to be, obviously. But I didn't want to have a child without doing some work on myself first, because I was born into a lot of ancestral rubbish. I was born into 4 generations in 1 household. And no one really had the, I love them all, but no one really had the self-awareness to have done any work. And I don't think it was as prominent a part of culture then to perhaps see a therapist, or to, you know, to take a long, hard look at oneself, or to actually have hard conversations, you know, and to deal with things out in the open. Everything was just suppressed or swept under the carpet. So I sort of absorbed all of that as a kid, and then had to spend my adult life unlearning a lot of behaviors. So I did most of that, I think, I hope, before having my child, which made it a very different process.
So you felt like you were ready, as it were?
As ready as one can be. He showed up early, obviously, because he's like me. I live by the saying, the only way to be on time is to be early, and he was that. We still had decorators in the house, so you can imagine we've got 2 big dogs, and they can't socialise. And then it wasn't just like, you know, one ceiling in one room being plastered. It was a whole house being redecorated.
Oh, man.
You know, like, oh, yeah, let's get this done before the baby arrives. So we haven't got to get it done when he's here. And then he shows up 2 weeks early and we've still got builders in. And it was, we've only just literally started to move back into our own house. But it's been fine. We've had a pretty welcome distraction.
Yes, you have. Yes, you have. And have you noticed even the most sort of basic of things? Like, I found this, especially with the first, and people say, oh, it changes completely for the second and third. Actually, it doesn't. The joy, the elation, the fascination, the intrigue, the whole new learning about yourself, it never changes. It's just, it's a slightly different variant. But certainly with the first, for example, I discovered that I had become a totally different sort of human being. I'll give you an example, see if this rings true with you. Even the most basic advert had me basically in tears, like an advert with a slightly sentimental topic to it. I'd be like, oh, so well. You know, my emotions were heightened to the next level. Have you heard
right,
of that?
Yes, but I've got 2 theories. I think one is that you do genuinely, sorry, I'm just trying to get my dog back in without them killing the cat. My dogs. I think there is, I've got two theories around that. And I think one is that you do genuinely become, your emotions are obviously more heightened, especially with all the oxytocin running through the system. But then there's also the sleep deprivation. And, you know, my recent endeavors into starting the business, a gulp, and just kind of going down every rabbit hole health-wise, you can imagine, led me to reading a lot about sleep. And the first part of your faculties that you lose when you suffer sleep deprivation is the ability to respond rationally to pretty much anything. So you end up going from highs, like high highs, to the lowest of lows really quickly. Mm. And I think that probably plays a part into, you know, the reason I've cried at, I'm trying to think of something now. I want to give you something I've actually cried over. I mean, it's easy to say I've cried over the news, but that's not that hard at the moment, is it?
That's true. That's true.
No, I mean, let's move on.
I think mine was like a washing machine advert or something. I was like, what am I doing? What's going on? It's so great. They've now got clean clothes. You know, it was like, that was that kind of thing. You know,
but definitely blame it on the sleep deprivation. I think for me, there's been a lot of like, there's been a lot of happy tears, you know, just in that he hasn't been born into the same situation that I was. And don't get me wrong, man, like my childhood was amazing. I had so, I was surrounded by so much love, you know. The same thing that had its negatives had so many positives. Four generations, you know. My mum, who did leave when I was a year old, my dad wasn't around that much. Then my grandmother and then my great-grandmother, you know. It was unreal. My great-grandmother lived through two world wars, and sadly she passed when I was 13, which is when I was just starting to ask the right questions, you know, when she explained to me what Hackney looked like pre-Second World War and, you know, why there were so many council estates and stuff like that, and what life was like. And, you know, she took a lot of what I would have liked to have known to the grave with her, bless her. But I had her for 13 years, and all the time I was absent from school, which was quite a lot of my childhood, she was there. So I never missed out on, you know, I think when people are brought up in single parent homes, they quite often miss out on that because, you know, they don't always come home to someone at home because they're at work, because they have to provide. And they miss out on that nurture, and I didn't miss out on that. And I definitely got the softest side of my great-grandmother because, you know, she'd already raised her children and then seen three grandchildren grow up. So I got the softest, you know, my nan always said I had her wrapped around my little finger, and I think maybe I did. But she's, her and my grandmother, you know, they're huge contributions to the good parts that are in me. You know, I saw my nan working three jobs a day. So, you know, with that kind of example of work ethic, made me want to work hard. Seeing how little she got for how hard she worked definitely made me want to work smarter as well, because I think there's, you know, the idea that hard work equals a good outcome is not necessarily the case. There's a lot of people who work extremely hard for nowhere near their value.
Right. No, that's completely valid. I mean, let's sort of dig a little and flesh out what you've talked about, because of course, for the listener that isn't aware of your journey and your story, you know, you've touched on a few of the sort of early foundation parts. Your parents were very young when they had you. You know, it's easy to say, well, my mum was, she left after a year, but she was very young. I'm not trying to make excuses, but I'm just
no. Listen, it's not even an excuse. That's a reason. She was 16. You know, she was 16, and her and my dad was split up as well. My dad was 18, so. I mean, look, I'm not far off 38. So the idea of having, you know, a child at less than half my age is incomprehensible.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. And you've also mentioned Hackney. You were brought up on a council estate. You know, but as you say, that the house that you were brought up in, the flat you were brought up in, basement flat, it was full of love, wasn't it? It was a full house.
It was also full of chaos. It was also full of, I was loved. I don't know about everyone else. There was, you know, because they were adults and they had quite fraught relationships based around conflict, which they never discussed.
Okay.
Ever. And I think that was the, you know, that stiff British upper lip. And that had a purpose. You know, I do think there's situations where even now you have to kind of just, you know, keep quiet, puff your chest up and get through things to get through them. But then what I think we, you know, it's important to highlight is the necessity to go back to those things and to understand them and not let them dictate your behaviours.
Yeah. Yes, you're a very deep thinker, aren't you? You've obviously put a lot of time into analysing life, humans, and how we connect.
Too much time. Overthinking was a part of my problem. You know, something that comes from therapy was like, generally, you know, I don't worry about things when they happen. In the moment of crisis, I'm cool and calm. I worry about things pre them happening or pre them perhaps never happening, which is more often the case, which is a complete waste of time because, you know, worrying about the corners you can't see around is pointless. You're never going to be able to see around corners. And, you know, worrying about something after it's happened is also pointless. It stops you from being present and from moving on. So learning how to sever ties is quite important.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that you've had to deal with and live with from the start, really. I mean, you know, we'll talk about, if it's all right with you, your great-grandmother you've touched on first, what an influence she was on you, what a remarkable and kind, lovely woman she was. You had her till you were 13. And she recognised early on, as far as I understand it, Stephen, correct me, of course, if I'm wrong, and apologies if I'm being dumb, but from what I can glean, she recognised what a smart young man you were, what a special young man. She taught you to read. She got you interested in things that weren't just your immediate surroundings. Is that right?
Yeah, I was quite ahead of my years when I went to school, thanks to my great-grandmother. She used to sleep in our living room on a chair that sort of folded into a bed. They do fancy ones now. This one was by no means fancy, because there were six of us in a three-bedroom flat, and it wasn't quite, Charlie and a Chocolate Factory, but it was quite, there wasn't that much space. And so I'd run out of, I used to share a room with my nan, and I'd run out of there every morning, which was literally through one door into the living room where my great-grandmother was, and jump under her blue blanket and disturb her. And I always tell this story the same way, but it will never change because it was as it was. When the BBC had that weird holding sign with the little girl holding the puppet, with like the which in hindsight is really scary.
To be fair, thinking about it now, it's creepy.
I don't think of it fondly. And so she would just read to me all the time, and stuff that I didn't understand, obviously, because at the time when she started reading to me, I didn't understand much. And she would continuously read things to me that were ahead of where I would have been otherwise. And then I began to read back to her, word for word, paragraph for paragraph, page for page. And then that kind of, it meant that I sought validation in the right places. I was quite an anxious child. That said, I was, I was quite quiet as well. But that said, if I ever had something to say, I would say it. So maybe in hindsight, less quiet and more considered. Giving myself a bit more credit now than I perhaps did before. But she also taught me numeracy, and she just inspired my mind and my inquisitiveness, really. I was quite curious, so I was eager to learn. And because I guess I saw a bit of her in each of the teachers that I had, I wanted to, there's bad sides of wanting to be, wanting to please people, because you become a people pleaser. You end up saying yes to everyone that wants something and not ever, being yourself, you're just whoever someone needs you to be. That said, it helped me early on, but I had a problem with absence, and that's kind of, that's the step beyond anxiety. Anxiety and absence go hand in hand. As we're at 11, I got the chance to sit the exam for St. Paul's, which, a kid from Hackney who's already been to three different primary schools, that doesn't happen much. But I just said to my nan, I don't want to do it. It's not for me. I felt like at 11, I already knew my place in the world. And to be honest, I don't think I would have done that well there. I mean, I ended up in a pupil referral unit by 13 anyway. So education wasn't something. And bearing in mind, education wasn't something. Well, it wasn't something that was in my family at that point. No one had ever been to university. Since then, my young cousin Charlie has, and he got a first in the masters. So we are slowly changing the course of our family bit by bit. It was her that definitely inspired me to use this whatever I have in between my two ears.
Do you, I use the term lightly, Stephen, because it's not a good emotion to kind of have, really, but do you regret at all any of the decisions you made around your education when you were almost too young to know what you were deciding, if that makes sense?
Yeah, no, I think I was allowed to make decisions that I was making when I was too young to make them, to be honest. Mm. But I can't regret them. I think regret and guilt, beyond apologising for whatever you may have done and being sincere in that, I don't think they're useful. Regret and guilt don't really allow for you to, again, you're still attached to something, after the fact of it's happened. You can't do anything beyond what you've done if you've done everything within your power to fix what you've done wrong. So I don't think it's healthy to live with, unless the only option is to learn to live with regret, but yeah. To have them as constants and to kind of have them ruminating constantly is not healthy.
Yes,
I think that's something being wrong.
It's very easy, isn't it, to sit back and judge your past, and moreover, it's even easier for other people to sit back and judge someone else's past, because they weren't living it, they weren't experiencing it, and they have no idea what the reality was day to day. If you look at the nutshell of what happened, you had the smarts to go to this fancy school, you had the kind of foundation thanks to your great gran, you clearly had the aptitude, you chose not to, school didn't work out for you, and you know, from the basic level, people will be going, oh, you should have tried harder at school. It's not like that, though, is it? That's not what we're dealing with. And you sort of, you've talked about...
No, but people are quick to judge. And I always think people that judge without having been at least present, I think it says a hell of a lot more about their character than the person that they're perhaps judging. I think it's all too easy to pass judgment. And we kind of live in a culture where everyone passes judgment on everyone and on every part of every person, you know, whether it's aesthetics or, you know, life choices or, and they forget, you know, like when people look at my life and they ask me about, you know, traumas and things that happened, because there were some quite specific moments that always get brought up when I got stabbed, when my dad took his own life. You know, they talk about those things as being, or they expect those to have been the larger traumas in my life. But actually, I think the things that hurt me more were cumulative and occurred over time. You know, growing up, where I did, how I did. I think that probably played more into what I had to remedy later on in life than any one thing.
Yes, which is a very powerful thing to say, and something that I think people will be quite surprised to hear, because of course, as you've just mentioned, two major moments which we will obviously talk about, perhaps not in the way that you've spoken about them historically, because as you say, it's a well-trod path and you've already sort of addressed them. But you know, to be able to say, well, actually, yes, you know, I was stabbed and my father killed himself and so on, but that wasn't the biggest challenge growing up, that's a pretty landmark thing to hear, Stephen. And incidentally as well, I hope you don't think I'm judging you. I'm asking questions. I'm certainly not judging. I just sort of want to make that point.
Thank you for highlighting that. Not many people do, but yeah, I kind of didn't expect that of you.
Oh, well,
I know we've only been speaking for a short time, but I get a pretty good vibe from you.
Oh, well, thank you. It's entirely mutual, and it's a real pleasure to have this chat, and I really appreciate your honesty. Can we talk a little bit about, and again, this is not making assumptions or anything like that, but it's just something on your timeline. You know, we sort of, because I think it's important to understand you as a person, everything that's going through your head as a young man, you know, at this stage after 13, you'd lost this wonderful rock, this wonderful sounding lady, your great grandmother, you know, the school choices, they are what they are. You did find yourself, and you know, I'll sort of tread lightly here, but you did find yourself, you know, there was a drug situation and you even started dealing, I believe. Is that right? I'm asking questions, not sort of making statements.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't make statements ever. That's not what we do where I'm from. Yes, that is what happened. And it was, you know, I began selling weed at quite a young age. It was a commodity, to be honest. And it's kind of funny when you look at, you know, the legislation that like being passed in certain countries now and the benefits of that. It always seemed like a harmless crime to me for the most part. But I did that for quite a long time. I never sold any harder drugs, if you know, if I can be open. Mm. You know, I never sold crack or smack because I don't believe in dealing with people in the most desperate situations they've ever been in their lives on a day-to-day basis. I think that brings, you know, they call brown bad luck for a reason, you know?
Right.
I did. It was funny. My nan never used to know what the smell was. And one day she went to her mate, Linda's, who used to live by Victoria Park, and Linda's partner, or Lynn or Linda, I can't remember, and her partner Dave was in the back garden, and he was smoking. And my nan recognised the smell, and she went, "How's that smell?" And she went, "Oh, Dave's in the back garden smoking that wacky backy." And my nan come home and hit the roof. I was like, oh, bloomin' heck, here we go. But I moved out quite, you know, I kind of facilitated a decision for my nan to move out of Hackney when I was starting to get further into that. And I moved out of my nan's house shortly after. And, you know, it was something I said I would never do. And I never did do. I never took police to her door.
Right. Yes. And it sounds like you kind of understood that. Sorry, my phone's, apologies there. It sounds like you understood responsibility from a very early age. You were very much like, this is on me. I own this. I will keep this to me.
Yeah, definitely, because no one was going to, you know, if anyone was going to get in trouble for it, it was going to be me that was going to have to deal with the repercussions, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Or it should have been.
But people could, a lot of people would have hidden. A lot of people would have, especially at such a young age, would have just gone, oh, not my problem. No. That wasn't me. You know, it's the old Shaggy song, isn't it?
Yeah, that was around a completely different circumstance.
Well, true. Yeah. I'm just trying to use a lyric. because it helps. So again, I'm trying to get into your mind, you know, the sort of 16, 18, 19 year old you who's...
For me then, all right, well, let me explain to you how it happened. So I was quite lucky. I think what kept me out of a lot of trouble, bearing in mind that a lot of my friends went, you know, they were youth offenders, and, you know, were institutionalized from a very young age. And I think what kept me out of that a little bit was I used to skate. So I knew people from all over London and outside of, and traveled with it a little bit because I was quite good at it from quite a young age. And that was, you know, being part of that subculture was amazing because it kept me out of what was going on back in Hackney. Albeit when I went to skate, I had to carry my baggy jeans and my skates in a bag to Clapton train station, get on a train and then get changed into my baggy jeans when I was in, when I got to Liverpool Street. I used to always use the McDonald's toilet to change in because I didn't really want to be seen as a skater in Hackney, because then I'd have been deemed a grunger and that would have come with certain, you know, difficulties.
Okay.
Not everything was as accepted, you know. Hackney wasn't, people think of Hackney now as Broadway Market, and, you know, everyone wants to live in Hackney now, you know, especially people who have grown up in Wiltshire. But it's, you know, Hackney was a very different place when I was growing up. You couldn't pay people to live there. Now people can't afford to live there. But so what happened was, amongst my group of friends who were skaters, because of the people that I knew, I had access to weed. So I would always get weed for them. And then I was like, well, if I'm getting, you know, if I'm buying this for this person and this for that person, why don't I buy a little bit more because it costs the same price, and then I can get my weed for free? You know, it was, I guess, the brain my great grandmother had given me kicking in, and my skill with numbers. It was quite, you know, it was quite easy mathematics.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of how it began. And then, you know, you fast forward and all of a sudden I'm picking up 10 kilos for 30 grand. It's a different thing, isn't it? But that was the entry, and that was a progression.
Wow. And you use the phrase, you know, you're getting your weed for free, which makes me assume that you were, you know, you enjoyed a bit of a smoke yourself, presumably.
I did use the, yeah, now I'd be scared.
Right.
I still love the smell of it. It doesn't treat me how it used to.
Stephen, just
sorry,
just listening to this kind of journey and this, I mean, quite frankly, incredible young man, you know, with all this thought that you would put into everything, you know, from being as simple as not wanting to be seen in skating gear, you know, around your neighborhood, to, you know, to all the different levels at which your brain was kind of was thinking. And of course, you must have been wondering about your parents and your relationship with your mum and dad and so on as a young lad. How much were you aware, whilst you were bringing up, that this perhaps wasn't a standard childhood? It wasn't a traditional route, as it were.
A little bit more once I started to meet people from different backgrounds. And that was the good thing about Hackney when I was growing up, is that, like, people always go, oh my God, that must have been terrible. But you don't have perspective. You know, you're not growing up in, you know, a nice part of the Cotswolds until you're 13 and dropped into a situation, you know, like all of a sudden from, you know, a middle to upper class family that loses all of their money, that then ends up in Hackney, and, you know, all of a sudden have to deal with all the challenges that come with growing up in a low socioeconomic background. That's not how it is. So you don't see both sides of the coin. But then once I started to meet people from, I met Sinead O'Connor's son through skating, you know, going to, you know, their place in Notting Hill and seeing how they lived, and just seeing the differences and understanding that. I used to think, you know, there were people who were quite expressive, sort of mid to late teens, and felt freer than I ever did to be who I was. And that was, I guess, because I you know, when you talk to people from wealthier backgrounds, they're not so attached to where they came from. It's more often their school, whereas my identity was Hackney. And I think that's what happens with a lot of young people now. They feel a lack of purpose, so their identity becomes where they're from. I mean, London's, you know, a big and a small place at the same time. You know, it would be better for your identity to be a Londoner, wouldn't it? But I think for some growing up now, you know, you look at people arguing over postcodes, and it's even worse in postcodes now. It's, you know, it can be in a neighbouring estate. And people's worlds become very small. I think because I used to skate and I saw a little bit more of the world than most of my friends did, and I was introduced to people from different walks of life and became comfortable with them. I wasn't, you know, everyone kind of has these, you know, we all display stereotypes of, you know, people who talk one way, who are from one background, and those of us who are more common, such as myself. And it's always the kind of, you know, the sensationalized or stereotype, isn't it? Or the kind of hyper reality of, you know, the people we discuss. And that generally comes from fear because we don't know them and we don't feel comfortable because we think we're going to be judged. We pass judgment because we're scared of being judged. And I didn't really have that. It's weird. You know, my nan wasn't and isn't perhaps the most comfortable person in certain spaces, but always taught me that, you know, your class isn't dictated by what you have in your pocket or your bank. It's by how you treat people. So I was just, you know, I went about wherever I went with the attitude that if I'm polite to everyone, then I'm fine wherever I am. I don't need to be uncomfortable. And that helped me. Yes. And it still helps me, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. But were you, it's a strange one this, but I'm going to ask it. Did you find that whilst you weren't necessarily trying to judge others, you know, when you were following your nan's advice, were you maybe overly judging yourself at the time?
Perhaps. I mean, there was definitely times when I was probably a bit harsher on myself than I should have. But I think it's also good to be your own worst critic. I'd rather worry about my opinion of myself than someone else's.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah, if you, I mean, obviously, you know, we established at the very start, you're a new dad, which is amazing, and you've done all this work on yourself and so on. But if you were able to go back, and it's so easy to reminisce, isn't it? But if you were able to go back to you, age, I don't know, 8, 9, 10, with you now, would you have said, just carry on, just follow this path, because ultimately it'll lead you to this excellent position that you're in now, or would you have changed things?
You're the only person to ever ask that question and offer that up, and you offered my answer. I would only ever, so, I mean, hypothetically, I would change a million things, but in all actuality, I would, you know, in reality, I would just say carry on, because, you know, that was the best thing to do, and that was actually what I did do, and that was the best lesson for all of the anxiety and the absence and the fear and the knots in my stomach that I dealt with through, you know, the beginning of my life. I had an operation when I was 6 weeks old to fix a defect in my digestive tract. And there was all of this, you know, is it a physiological problem, and back and forth to the doctors and then the hospital. And, you know, it wasn't quite Munchausen's, you know, but it was like, you know, am I sick or aren't I? I was diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome when I was like 5 or 6 years old. And, you know, no one ever suggested to me, and I didn't really have the language or the tools or the knowledge and understanding to realize that a lot of the pain that I had in my stomach wasn't pain really. It was anxiety. And, you know, that it's not, that feeling isn't that dissimilar to excitement. But I understand that in adult age, and I just realized that I'm quite a sensitive person, as are most people, you know, if they allow themselves to be, and that most things that I feel go to my gut.
Yes, the gut and the brain, the emotion in particular, they're very, very connected, aren't they?
Well, they're intrinsically linked by the longest nerve in the body, the vagus nerve. And it used to be thought that it was a one-way street and it was just information from the brain to the gut, but it's actually a two-way street, and 80-90% of the information is sent via the gut and the rest of your organs, actually, to your brain.
Yeah, yeah. It's, I mean, this is something that you have become something of an expert on. You've got a gulp, there's the Let's Talk Bleep campaign, and I'm very, very keen to learn all about this and what it means, what it's going to become. It would be wrong of me, just from a broadcasting perspective, to not go on the subjects that you've touched on, Stephen. So if it's, yep, okay, we will discuss those. You know, it's the whole, and as you've said, these aren't landmark moments in your mind because you've lived it. But of course, if it's a Wikipedia summary, there are some standout moments that you know, people will say to me, well, why didn't you ask him about that? So of course, you know what I mean? Of course, I have to
talk, yeah, of course,
if you're okay with this.
Yeah, yeah, I'm okay with everything. I'm an open book. I just segue a lot.
Well,
you have to rein me in. That's the hardest thing you'll have with this conversation.
Have you ever been on a Segway?
No, for as good as I was as a skater, I don't trust those things.
Why not?
I don't think they look very cool either.
No, they don't, do they? No, you want a tangent? Then we'll talk public mobility and segue opportunities. What's no one ever asked you, Stephen? That's the conversation we need to have.
You've just asked me something that no one has ever asked me. So there we go.
Wow. All right. We'll take that. You know, the top lines, and it's horrific to describe them like that. But you know, there's so much more, I believe, that we should be talking about in this time. So let's go there. Age 24. You know, just talk me through what happened. Your perspective of it with your father.
Yeah, I woke up on a Wednesday morning. The last time I'd seen him, I was 18. I woke up on a Wednesday morning to my nan running into my room. I'd moved back home briefly. She just burst into my room. I barely even opened both my eyes. And she says, "Stephen, your dad's dead. He's hung himself." Don't get me wrong. There's no gentle way. I mean, I don't think I'd have really appreciated her trying to, you know, I don't know, wake me up, say, "Hey, Stephen, let's go get a coffee and then maybe go to Selfridges or up the West End for the day." Not that was ever something we did. And then broke it to me. But it was a pretty, you know, I think your first hour when you wake up and probably your last hour before you go to bed are the most vulnerable hours of the day, which is why I try and avoid making any decisions or my phone for that matter and the TV during those times. So to be woken up with that news was, it was heartbreaking, man. And I went through a whole spectrum of emotions very, very quickly. I punched the wall, I screamed, I called him selfish, swore a lot, cried my eyes out. And he had done it the night before. And I had no idea. I had no idea that he was going through that because we hadn't seen each other. We'd spoken just over a year before, around Christmas time. The last conversation I had with him was on the day after Boxing Day. I'd gone to buy something in the sales. Probably a computer game. I was in Walthamstow. I just bought Burger King. I was with my then girlfriend at the time, Tia. I remember it vividly. And he called on my mobile and I said, "So what's happening?" We were meant to meet up the day after. Bearing in mind that I said I'd never put my neck on the line for him again. I'd never make myself vulnerable for him. I'd never give him the chance to hurt me again. But actually, I realized that it was hurting me a hell of a lot not having him in my life because he was such a kind, caring, and charming gentleman. He was just a rubbish father. And he said, you know, he mentioned his wife's name and her kids, his stepchildren, and how excited they were to see me. And I was like, you know, it was the first time I ever stood up and said how I felt. I'd always been too scared prior to that as a child because I was scared he would disappear for a year and a half again. And I'd end up sitting in our front room window, you know, in our living room, looking at the bus stop directly outside, waiting for him to get off a bus every day, which he never did. And I just said to him, "This isn't about me having to play happy, you know, this isn't about me playing happy families. This is about you and I sitting down and talking about everything and trying to develop some sort of or even seeing if we can develop a relationship as adults."
Yes.
And he started to stutter and, you know, and I just said, I probably kissed my teeth and said, "You know what, if I ever see you again, I'm going to knock you out." And that was the last conversation we ever had.
Yeah, and then a year later, like you say, he's hanged himself.
And then I ended up IDing his body. No one would walk in. His family would, you know, I understand. It wasn't easy, but you know, it wasn't easy to have to do that and be the first person to walk in and see him like that, either having not seen him for so long, and then to see him lying there like that. It's a very harsh reality, but it is a reality. And I think it's important that people, you know, they understand what's on the other side of that because it's a hell of a lot of pain. But I don't think, and I haven't thought for a long time that he's selfish for the decision he made. You have to understand, right? My dad was a very, very passive man. If he had a problem at all, he was weak. And there's a lot that contributed to that. I found out a lot of that by way of a documentary I made for the BBC in 2013, yes. I think.
Suicide and Me.
So for him to make such a violent decision to end his own life when he wasn't a violent man was very, very difficult for me to understand. And for ages I wanted to understand how he made that decision, but I say this often, the only way I would ever understand that is if I found myself in the same situation that he was in, and I never want to be. in that situation. I will never be in that situation. I can say that quite matter of fact. So I had to let that one go.
Yes, yes. I mean, Stephen, obviously this is a subject that has been discussed by you and you know, the public are aware of. You know, there was your autobiography, there was that, as you know, the BBC Three show that you touched on, and I've heard you talk about this in other interviews, and it must be incredibly difficult mining from it time and again. So I asked this.
On that, it isn't. I think this is something that people don't realise. You know, we suppress things all too often, and if you push something down, it often just comes up and hits you from the side. Whereas, you know, I'm not. It will always be sad what my dad did. You know, especially now I have a son. You know, I would love for him to be able to have had a grandfather. I would like to have had a father. But the fact that I am very, you know, these things have been very present in my mind for a long, long time. And I've had many of these conversations, and it still catches me off guard sometimes and makes me teary. But for the most part, and it's not that I'm like, I've become some sociopath and completely disengaged with my emotions or feelings, but it's more present. So it's easier to discuss without, you know, because I don't hide from it.
No, I completely understand that because, of course, you know, the reality is that we all live in our current moments. We all live in what we're doing right here, right now. And I'm going to, I don't really know how to phrase this, Stephen, so bear with me. I'm not trying to be, but, you know, hearing you talk about this, that being stabbed in the neck and so on, you know, these are sort of outlying moments to the public in your life. But the way you talk about them now, it's a little bit like, and again, this is just an observation and it's not a judgment on any level, but it's a bit like, you know, we all go to dinner parties or whatever, and we're meeting new people and so on. And it's only the people that are really close to us, you know, like my wife, for example, she's heard me tell a certain story exactly the same way 100 times over, you know, and she'll know in her head, oh yeah, he's going to do that one now. Whereas the people that are with me now, I'm telling it because they've never heard it and they're interested in. But how I'm connecting to that story, it's almost just I'm going through the history of this story now rather than the impact of the event, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Do you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah. It's well, and I guess that goes back to what I was saying, right? Is that it's less the single moment that the trauma happens, it's more the cumulative effect of things that happen over time, because there were things I went through, you know, for a long time before that, and then there was things I went through for a long time after that, which actually, you know, the amalgamation of which were what caused the problem.
Yes. Yes, and
something starts the fire, but you know, it's when it burns that it hurts.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm assuming it's not something that you try to allow to occupy your everyday on a frequent basis.
It can't. I've got too many other things occupying my mind. You know, it's a birthright of mine, right? I'm British. I complain a lot. but I used to. I complain less now, and I guess that's because I've kind of accepted I'm not that happy unless I am overwhelmingly busy. I like to keep my mind occupied, and I think that's, you know, I used to, it can be a gift and a curse, an overactive mind, and is it overactive or is it just well engaged? You know, but I did suffer from OCD. I have overanalyzed every part of my life probably 16 times over. I've got a lot better at not doing that and focusing on matters at hand and applying that sort of, you know, that energy into the things that I enjoy doing, the people that I enjoy spending time with.
How do you quieten the mind now and the overthinking?
I do things that relax me. I find I have to do, you know, it's been a bit more difficult of late. It's like it has been for everyone over the last year. You know, everyone has suffered varying degrees of what's been going on. But generally, you know, it would be, I find I need to do things that allow me to think, and I need to do things that allow me not to think about anything apart from the whatever's in front of me. So that might be a tire that I'm flipping or a cycle that I'm on, or, you know, on the flip side of that, what allows me to think, you know, walking my dogs, driving my car, playing music, sitting in a room on my own, which I don't get that much of a chance to do. And something I haven't missed as much as some people, I think, the last year has been the social obligations, of which there used to be many. which didn't allow me as much time. And I found that that was when things got difficult and started to feel unmanageable. And that was when I would probably make decisions which led to me doing things which made things easier in the interim, but longer in the, you know, harder in the long term. You know, and I realized, I was like, why am I somewhere? I was like, oh God, if I'm going to be here, I'm going to have a drink. And you can imagine how many events there are with, you know, that come with all the various things I did that, you know, involved media, I suppose. Yeah. And what I did as an artist. And I was like, wait a minute, why am I going to places where I feel like I have to have a drink just to be? And it wasn't because I was socially anxious and I couldn't be anywhere without having a drink. It's just because I went to a lot of places where I didn't really want to be. And that was because I felt obliged to. And then I realized that I wasn't, and that the world wouldn't stop, and that I'd still sell records and I could still engage with my fans if I didn't go to all of these things that I was encouraged to do to, you know, to keep up appearances.
Yeah, see and be seen.
Which people are now desperate to do for a career. I find that mental.
Yes, it's but then that's because you've done it. You know, you're allowed to find it mental because you know what the reality is. You know, whereas we sort of humble observers simply see the stage and the sales and the cars and all that stuff, you know, and it seems
good. Yeah. Yeah, I suppose it is, but then things are very different now, and there's very different opportunities. You know, I there was no such thing as an influencer. When I was growing up, it was, you know, you had to have a craft that you were good at. I never wanted to be famous. I wanted to become a successful musician. And then I fell into a few other things, presenting and documentaries and whatnot. And I was like, okay, well, I want to do that as good as I've done, as good as I've done everything else. I do find the other side of it a bit weird, you know, just wanting that. And we see what it does like psychologically to people that don't, you know, I think it's probably quite difficult for people when they go from 0 to 100. You know, 1 minute they're working in a bank, the next minute they've got 2 million followers on Instagram. They get stopped everywhere they go. People are not necessarily as kind, and it has a huge impact on them. And we've seen people take their own lives because there's been no support in place for them. So I have a very weird relationship with the state of affairs as they are currently.
Yes, I think fame and celebrity are very unusual words these days, and they don't necessarily mean what they used to, what they were when we were growing up. And it's
God, that makes me sound old now, doesn't it? It's really showing my age. In my day.
Yeah, well, I'm older, so, you know, easy.
I'm not far off.
Not far off, yeah. You'll catch up at some point. You know, I'm actually very keen to talk to you a lot about Agulp. I want to know all about it from a personal perspective, as well as what's going on with you and the plans for it and the Let's Talk Bleep campaign properly. I do feel it would be completely remiss if we don't talk about the stabbing, the Mercedes incidents and so on. We don't have to dwell on them, but you know, are you cool talking about it? You know, I haven't met many people that have been stabbed in the neck and crushed between two cars and fractured their neck during a seizure and so on. Can you sort of...
Oh, I forgot about that one.
You forget that's the most recent. How could you forget about that one? So, yeah, I mean, what defines it? How do they stand out to you?
A lot of people got stabbed when I was growing up. People probably try and join dots and think that I got stabbed because of what I was involved in. That perhaps there was some deservingness of. You know, in me deserving it happening, and there wasn't. It was just a random event in a nightclub. I bumped into someone. Well, I didn't actually. I moved past them with. I said, "Excuse me." The first time, there was two people in conversation. It was a packed club. It was loud. He didn't hear me. I said, "Excuse me." The second time, and I'm an extremely passive person as well. You know, much like my father, and moved past him with an open hand on his back, as you do to make space without barging into someone or bumping into someone. Long and short of it, his friend accused me of barging in, started to get really rude, and all I did was stand up for myself, and I thought I was right to do that. In hindsight, I could have just gone, you know what, sorry, mate, and it would have been done. I'm a much calmer person now than I was. I was a little bit younger and a little bit more reactive. And I stood up for myself, and all of a sudden he didn't want the trouble that he had started, and I thought it was over and done with. And then 5 minutes later, he walked up behind me and put a broken bottle in my neck.
Yeah, and it could have killed you very, very easily, couldn't it? It was
15 minutes away on that in Amherst Road. But bearing in mind that they're both in Hackney, a 16-year-old got stabbed in his neck and he died. So on the same night, mine went right past my carotid. When I got to hospital, you know, they were. When I got to hospital. Bearing in mind, I've never been a gang member. I've never liked violence, and I was treated as though I was as in the wrong as the person who had stabbed me. I got arrested as well. So I wasn't treated that kindly when I got to hospital. And I understand they're stressed. They see a lot of shootings and stabbings in that hospital because of, you know, how, you know, the surrounding areas are, and how people live and what they suffer. So I guess, you know, they just assume that, probably done something to deserve it. But in this instance, nope. It was a random event, and it went right past my carotid. I went down for surgery, and they thought I'd be down for 45 minutes. They thought it was superficial, which seems crazy to me, but it had gone right through my salivary glands. It had actually stopped at my bone. The only reason it didn't go right through my throat was because it hit my jawbone, and it was millimeters away from my carotid artery. And they also made a nerve twitch during surgery, so when I come round and I was still a bit out of it, they were like, you shrug your shoulders, and I was trying to laugh, like, what are you on about? And they're like, no, you might have lost the use of your arms. Can you shrug your shoulders, please? So yeah, I was again very lucky. So that's that.
Yeah, and it's left you with a sizable scar on your neck, just underneath the tattoo you'd had just a few weeks earlier, saying lucky madly.
Yeah, and how lucky was I? It's funny, people always go, you were unlucky, and it's like, no, because there's a lot of people who find themselves in those situations. You don't come out the other side of them, especially not when they get poked in the neck. If you're gonna get stabbed, there's definitely better places for it to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Has it given you a fear of death?
No, I think when I got you referenced me getting hit into the back of my own lovely Mercedes. It was an SLS I had back then. I finally got my own Batmobile. I loved Batman as a kid. I still quite enjoy it now. Not the films in between the first, the second, and the last three. They were all awful. Someone had their car in eco, didn't realise that the car was in eco, the engine had stopped. And so I was walking in between the two cars. It was quite a large distance between them as well, to the pavement. And the guy took his foot off of the brake, felt the engine start. He presumed the car was going to move forwards, which it wouldn't have. Eco is, you know, it's quite a good invention. It's not stupid. But the driver was, and he panicked and he went to slam his foot on the brake, and instead he slammed his foot on the accelerator and he hit me in the back. And luckily I got my hands on the bonnet, and this probably comes from my skating days and being really good at falling over. My reactions got my body up and out of the way, all but my left leg, as he smashed me into the back of my car as fast as, he could have gone between, I don't know, about 20 foot or something. It was a big V8 by turbo he had, though. It wasn't a small car, you know. And that affected me mentally way, way, way more than the stabbing, because, I don't know, I didn't know anyone who'd been hit by a car, and it seemed totally free. I know it sounds weird, but, you know, stabbings were somewhat normalised because of how frequent they were, you know, how frequent they occurred where I grew up. Whereas that was like, whoa, that just came out of, and I mean, I got stabbed out of nowhere, but again, this just seemed, you know, my life was in a pretty blimming good place. You know, I was off the back of doing two albums in 2 years, hadn't stopped touring, was actually due, I was off the back of a show the night before, had a show that night, which obviously I had to cancel. But believe it or not, I still got abuse on Twitter. Oh, I get it.
Because Twitter, yeah.
People still wanted to see the show. That kind of come out of nowhere. And so that took a little while to recover from, to be honest. And I don't think it was helped by the pain medication that I was given, which I ended up just stopping taking because I felt like I was, didn't feel very present, you know, taking Tramadol and Oramorph and whatever else I was on. I also threw my crutches away. I just started to lose my legs. I was suffering so much atrophy. I wasn't, and I needed to get back on my legs as quickly as possible. So I was a bit of a moany bugger. You can imagine pain doesn't make you the happiest, does it? But
No. And I imagine you weren't the best fun to be around either in terms of living with you.
Probably, my mates would probably say that was the case throughout most of the time they lived with me, but they have.
And then obviously you say you'd even forgotten about it. 2019, you had a seizure and you fractured your neck. I mean, that's not small.
No. I don't think I've ever had the flu before, if that is what the flu was. But to be fair, I'd had quite a mental schedule. I had been to Australia for 3.5 weeks. Come back, worked every day, from getting off the plane until I flew to New York on the Saturday. This was the first time I'd ever sort of travelled solo as well. I was like, sod it, I'm going to start going away without work because I've never done that before. You know, I'd always felt a bit of working class guilt. I'd always attached holidays to work and always felt a bit wrong taking them. I was like, no, I'm going to go and see a bit of the world and enjoy myself. And so I went to, so worked for every day for a week once I got back from Australia, and it got harder progressively because every time I wanted to sleep, I couldn't. And then every time I could sleep, I couldn't because of jet lag. And then went to New York. I got sick when I was in New York. I had a stomach bug, tried to enjoy myself the best I could while I was out there, got back and similarly worked every day from the, I don't know if it was a Monday or Tuesday, I flew back to the Friday when I eventually I did my last job and came home and was in bed until the Tuesday. I missed rehearsals for my tour, which I was due to start on the Tuesday. And rather than do the smart thing and just say, look, I can't do the first couple of shows, I tried to get up on the Tuesday morning and put some sort of suitcase together for the tour. And the last thing I remember doing was sending a friend a photo of my room before I'd packed the case, and then a photo of the case once I packed it, because it looked like the Tasmanian devil had been through my room prior. and then that was the last thing I remember. And then the next thing was my housemates surrounding me and me waking up in an absolute panic, not knowing what had gone on. And I'd had a seizure. Gosh. And that was when I got to hospital. They count all of the seizures as one seizure. I forget the type of seizure it was now. But if they happen in a cluster, they're one seizure. And because I have hemophilia B, it's way worse on paper than it is in practice. I had an operation at 6 weeks. They didn't find that out until I was 19. So if it was if it was bad, I would have died then. Right. So they were worried because I had this huge, I'd smashed my face when I'd fallen. I'm quite a lump. I'm 6'3", so I had quite a long way to go. They were worried about a brain bleed potentially.
Gosh, okay.
So they rushed me through, and after they came out and they were like, right, we've got some good news for you. There's no bleed. I was like, yes. And then it was like, but there's some bad news. I was like, oh God. And they were like, yeah, you fractured your C7. And a fracture is no different to a break, and a C7 is really, really high. So had that been any more severe, that would have had a completely different outcome as well.
So actually you've had several, well, three incredibly near misses.
Yes.
That must be something that's, I don't know how much you think about that, but that's quite a remarkable thing to consider.
By law of averages, and this comes from my therapist, he's like, you would think most of the larger traumatic events that are going to happen in your life have already happened, which at a point I probably would have been scared to say out loud or repeat. But, you kind of just have to crack on and hope that that's the case. Tell you what, though, I'm resilient, and that's something that goes, for all the mental health advocacy that I've been a part of. I started the conversation in 2013. There wasn't one being had publicly, not least of all by a rapper.
Yeah.
It is, I think the one thing that goes missing in that conversation when people are being encouraged to be more open, more honest, and more aware of their sensitivities, is resilience. And resilience is important, and it's difficult to understand how resilient you are unless you suffer. I think the only way to, and this is something I worked out for myself, the only way I think you can ever gather resilience mentally without suffering and surviving is by using therapy when you're not at a point of crisis. But we don't have a very proactive nature in this country when it comes to, you know, health overall.
Well, the truth is, though, isn't it? You can't fake mental toughness, and you can't fake experience, you know, and those two things lead you to the person you are, I think.
Yeah. I mean, every little thing, good and bad, plays into who you are, doesn't it?
It does.
And, you know, sometimes we all have to wear a mask. It's just like, you know, there are days when I don't want to do anything and I have to. And I still have to, especially in the job that I do. You know, I don't just get to kind of put my head down and get on with it. I have to show up.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that presents its own problems, but it is what it is. It's, you know, again, it's, you have to understand that they're your choices, and, you know, you do always have the option of saying no. You might not like what's on the other side of no, but you do have a choice.
Yeah, without any shadow of a doubt. Tell me about the Stephen of today, because, of course, you know, you're a new dad, which is incredible, and you're going through all that glory and exhaustion and fascination and intrigue. You've also started this new enterprise, A Gulp, which sounds like it's going to be doing as much good as you've been doing for people's mental health and starting the conversation, but it's also a practical solution to issues that a lot of people face. So talk me through it.
Yeah, man. Well, I'm still getting to know the Stephen of today, because it'll probably be a little bit different tomorrow. And I hope that continues throughout the rest of my life, to be honest. If you're not changing, that probably indicates you're not learning. Where's the point if you're not? And I'm still quite inquisitive and curious. And so in 2017, another dreadful situation, I had an operation to repair a hiatus hernia and some other bits that relate to the operation I had when I was 6 weeks old. And the operation went well, but I suffered severe complications because my body didn't enjoy it. Had ileus distension, pneumonia, collapsed lung, and a CRP, if anyone knows what that is, it's an inflammation marker of 672, which basically meant, again, I probably should have copped it. And after 2 weeks of them throwing everything at me they could to fix me, not knowing what the problem was, and I don't think any of it actually helped. I mean, like 100 milligrams of prednisolone, which is a steroid, as much as they could give me of the four strongest antibiotics that exist, which obviously done my gut no good. I started to get better and the inflammation started to reduce. They drained over 4 liters of inflammation through where they'd cut me open. And everything went back to normal apart from my stomach, which was almost entirely paralyzed, which meant that food wouldn't pass through, which was the same problem I had when I was born. I had pyloric stenosis, which meant that food wouldn't pass through my stomach. So, you know, all these years later, this was 2017, I'm back to square one with the same problem that I had. And the options were a surgery, which was a gastric bypass, which, if I suffered the same complications as I just had, which I was more likely to, I wouldn't have made it through the surgery. Or afterwards. So I said no to that, obviously. And so the only alternative was to try and find ways to heal myself holistically. And it's kind of weird that more traditional methods of medicine are called holistic, because actually, you know, traditional medicine, we think, is waiting until you're sick, going to a doctor and getting a prescription. But actually, you know, the most traditional pillars of medicine are sleep, movement, and food. A lot of us, like me in that situation, suffer from malabsorption. So even if you eat the most varied diet, you don't get enough of what you need. So I started to, because I couldn't, I wasn't able to, you know, solid food was putrefying in my stomach, because anything you eat has to be turned into a liquid before it can pass through to your small intestine, where the larger part of your, well, almost all nutrients are absorbed. It's only really fibers that pass through to feed your gut bacteria. So I started to look into liquid nutrition, and I found out about probiotics, prebiotics, fermented foods, as I started to be able to eat more. I bumped into a man called Kevin Godlington, who's now one of my best friends and business partners. He helped start The Book of Man, which is a website which I write for. And we got to talking, and it was one of those drunken conversations that, you know, things don't normally materialize after drunken conversations. They're a bit like, you know, friends you meet on holiday. But we were speaking about our encounters with, you know, gut health and mental health. And I realized that the better I took care of my gut, and as I started to get better, you know, the better my mental health was. And there would have obviously been a positive knock-on effect because my quality of life was improving. But even after my stomach was entirely healed, I found that if I stopped taking care of my gut, my mood, you know, my mood was worse. It was more inconsistent. My sleep was worse. And I started to join the dots between the two, and I started to do a lot of research between the two, bearing in mind I'm not a real professor. And I discussed all of this with Kevin, and he felt quite similarly, having a quite traumatic childhood himself and having suffered a lot of similar issues, having seen a lot of PTSD because he was ex-SAS or is ex-SAS. And we were like, look, the one thing about what I found about supplementing and nutrition is that it was a, you know, my morning routine was laborious. It took me about an hour to get through it all, and it didn't travel. So, and as soon as I took a break from it, things went back to, you know, things weren't as good almost immediately. You know, I started to notice ill effect of not following the same routine. So we were like, okay, between us, we have to be able to find a way that this can be made easier. So we began with the gut and the brain because we were so interested in the link between gut health and mental health. And it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation. You know, is it psychological trauma that causes gut issues, or is it gut issues that causes psychological problems? I think in different instances, it can be either. And there's more and more and more research being done around this now. There's almost a new paper written every day. In fact, that probably is. And we were like, there must be a way to condense all of these brilliant things that we found that work and that help into one thing. And also we found out about the poor efficacy of traditional pill form vitamins, which not only give your stomach a job, which if you've got an irritated stomach is going to make things worse immediately because you have to, you know, you're going to create stomach acid in order to break the pills down. But the stomach acid that breaks the pills down, it kills up to 95% of what's in the vitamin. So you're getting very little of what you're paying for. So we found, I mean, we knocked on a lot of doors and we got told to sod off because it was overcomplicated. And where's the point in doing that? That's crazy. And then we found a company which eventually said they would trial it. They used a method of delivery, which is targeted of, you know, that targeted treatments are 0.01% of all medication. And I'm not saying there's no place for medicine, because there wouldn't be such thing as liposomal technology if it wasn't for medicine. That was why it was developed. But basically it means that we're made of lipids, for people that don't know. Sorry if this is a bit like a science lesson, but
that's good to have. And liposomes, not a professor, and yet you've got the knowledge. Yeah, so, yeah, let's hear it.
Liposomes are a little bit like, in layman's terms, they're like waterproof onesies that protect whatever is inside them from your stomach acid, which is otherwise corrosive. So they get to where they need to go. But because they mimic human cells, they also, again, they further get to where they need to go and are far more effective. So we started a goal, and it began with a formula for gut and a formula for brain. And I mean, you know, people can go into Trustpilot and read the testimonials themselves. You know, the clinical trials went really, really well. And it was kind of crazy because you think, wow, this was a pipe dream, but this is actually helping people. And it's still, you know, I'm astounded till this day, and really humbled by the, you know, just the messages that I get from the positive effects that this is having on people's lives. We've now got formulas for immunity, for recovery, for sleep, which is something that I've suffered with to varying degrees throughout my life. And it's amazing to, you know, I wouldn't want to go through any of what I've been through again, but to be able to take some of what I've suffered and put that into something that can help people, much, I guess, in the same way that I was able to take my encounters either via my father or my own issues with my own mental health and, you know, take that and help others. It's kind of nice to be able to take a lifetime of suffering with my gut and put that into something that's able to help others. And I went through a lot of trial and error to find what worked for me. And I'm not by any means saying this will work for everyone or fix everything. I don't think there is one size fits all, but there are specific things which most of us are deficient in, knowingly or not. And you know, that can help, and that we should all endeavor to take, whether it's via more traditional methods, food, or, you know, supplements in this instance by way of a gulp.
And so this is, you know, in the most basic of terms, because you you know, you've described it brilliantly, and I need to dumb things down for myself. So this is, in essence, an individually tailored supplement that you would take, what, a breakfast or whatever, that'll actually address the issue that you're experiencing, be it gut or sleep issues or whatever, and it makes a tangible difference.
It makes a tangible difference, and I think, like, you know, when we have tests, when we go to the doctors, you know, it's to test whether you're deficient or sufficient. And it's like, you know, a blood test will determine whether you're ill or not ill. And you can be almost ill, but you'll be deemed not ill, you know, whereas you can be just sufficient in something which doesn't necessarily, you know, the difference between me having a what's considered sufficient level of B12 and an optimal level is the ability to get out of bed. It changes my life exponentially, because I don't retain B12 well, because I suffer with malabsorption. And a lot of people, especially as they get older, you know, they suffer with deficiencies they're not aware of. And it's not an overnight journey with gut, you know, but something like our brain formula, you know, you will take that and you will feel a difference immediately, you know, or after about 4.5 minutes, you know, you will feel the pickup. And it's not stimulant as well. You know, there's as many relaxants as there are things in there to support your, you know, the function of your brain. It's not just a caffeine fuel and sugar fueled stimulant like most things out there. It actually is, you know, it's, forgive the pun, but food for thought. You know, we focus on, so like our recovery sachet, which was, you know, born of the idea of, you know, not hangover remedy, because that's, you know, hangover is weirdly a medical term. You can't call something that. But I wanted to create something that, again, wasn't sugar and a caffeine. You know, I didn't want to create something to help people plaster over the cracks, but to replenish everything that we deplete when we do have one too many. But what we created in doing that was something that served a far larger purpose than just, you know, helping someone after a hangover, because it helps you replenish what you deplete, whatever the stress you put your body under is. So whether it's a workout, whether it's a double shift on the NHS,
just being a dad, would that be all right?
Yeah, well, that too, you know, and it's important, because it's, you know, I don't want to, and for me, it's, you know, I don't want to get ill. I don't want to get ill to have to get better. I want to stay well. And I think more and more people, especially after the last year, are starting to look into ways in which they can keep themselves healthier. And I'm trying to make a difference, you know. And the biggest piece of this for me, you know, as a business, and that's been a whole education in itself, you know, like the idea of running at a loss for a year was very scary to me. It's like, you what? How? Sorry. Yeah, sure. You know, and it's speculative, but again, it's a passion project, and it's something that I care so much about. And I think there's a bigger end goal here, and that's, you know, there's a huge, the educational piece is almost more important to me, because I think there's a lack of information, especially clear and concise information out there as far as nutrition, you know, and a lot of kids suffer with malnutrition. And the picture that we think of when we think of malnutrition is probably not a kid on his way to school in the London borough, but that is, you know, that sadly is, yeah, is sometimes. And I think if we can make a difference in that, I'll be very, 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 very happy. And they're simple, they're convenient, you know, they don't need refrigerating, they're in single serve sachets, which you can have when you wake up or when you're on your way to work or when you get home, however you so please. The whole point of it was to make it comprehensive and convenient, and also not, you know, not to be, so I don't know, a lot of people sell snake oil. Yeah. that was never the aim, you know. It's, you know what, the best thing about it is that there's so many, you know, there's so many things in place that stop us from making outlandish claims. It's good, you know, we don't have to make the claims. You can literally look on Trustpilot and see the results that people have seen from taking these lovely little sachets themselves.
I'm going to give it a try. Genuinely, just talking to you now, hearing about it, I've read a little bit about it myself. I'm up for this. This sounds great. I'm going to give it a try.
It took me 2.5 years having a few problems at my record label and not being able to release music at the, you know, as consistently as I would have liked. Actually gave me time to focus on this and do this properly. And yeah, it's kind of amazing to give birth to something and have ownership over it. I've always, give or take, been the product It's nice to have some ownership over the business, although that comes with its own anxieties.
Yeah, of course. That's startup glory, isn't it? Wow. Well, I mean, huge luck with this. I like I say, I'm going to try it myself, and I'll let you know how I get on, because it sounds great. This isn't an end to the music, though, is it? That's not stopped.
No. So on the 27th of this month, 25th of this month, I finally signed my new record deal. I get set free from where I was unable to release music, and that all starts again, which will almost coincide with us being allowed back out, which I can't wait for.
Perfect. Stephen, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you. It was worth the wait, man.
Cheers, man. I'm glad we got to do it. Thank you very much.
Have a great day. Thank you so
much. Take care. You too. Lots of love. Bye. Okay, man.
Bye-bye.
The Andy J Podcast.
So there you go, Stephen Manderson, Professor Green himself. What a guy, what a chat. I want to flag up, of course, if there's anything that you've heard today that has affected you, please visit the Samaritans. I believe it's samaritans.org. And I think from memory, their phone number is 116 123. That's 116 123. I will check that. So it is just samaritans.org. That will get you straight through. And the number, I believe I did say it correctly, it's 116 123. You can call them from a mobile phone or a landline or whatever for free. 116 123. Anyway, thank you so much for your company. I hope you are a regular listener. I hope you subscribe to the show. I'm looking forward to bringing you next week's conversation already. It's a big hitter. Oh, that was a terrible pun. It's Tony Bellew, boxing champ, who has just brought out his book. It's probably the best titled book ever. I love it. Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face. We're talking about him and his incredible life next week. Tell your friends, subscribe, like, share. And if you fancy giving us a nice review, writing a few lovely words, well, that would be really kind. Thank you for your company. We'll speak next week. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.